University of Queensland marine biologist Professor Peter Mumby's career has straddled the two great reefs of Australia and Belize. His wife of 22 years is Belizean. He says the reef is very ingrained in their identity. He says even before Belize hit the danger list, fishermen were seeing the damage from overfishing, particularly on parrotfish that help clean the reef, and were themselves lobbying the government to put restrictions on their catch. Professor Peter Mumby says both reefs are now being hit by climate change, but he worries a danger listing for Australia's Great Barrier Reef could reinforce a wrongly held perception globally that the reef is doomed. He says, but there does need to be that wake-up call to the Commonwealth government, adding, the reef is facing an uncertain future for sure. World Heritage Sites are enshrined on the United Nations list for their cultural or natural significance, or sometimes both. There are 53 sites on the World Heritage in Danger list, including Florida's Everglades, Indonesia's Sumatran rainforests, the city of Vienna, and Liverpool's historic waterfront, which could lose its World Heritage status entirely at next month's meeting. Next month's meeting, chaired by China, will decide the Great Barrier Reef status. UNESCO's recommendation is that the Great Barrier Reef should be placed on the in danger list, and the next version of the Queensland and federal government's Cornerstone Joint Reef 2050 policy should be explicit about how Australia will bring greenhouse gas emissions down in line with the Paris Climate Agreement. If the committee accepts the recommendations in full, then UNESCO wants to carry out a monitoring mission to develop a set of corrective measures that would also look at driving improvements to water quality, another key area of concern. Some tourism figures in Queensland fear an in-danger listing will be more bad news that could discourage international visitors from travelling to Australia once borders reopen. Dr. John Day, a former Australian government representative on the World Heritage Committee and a veteran of the meeting, says, I really think that's a furphy. He says when other sites have been placed on the danger list, there's no indication that visitor numbers went down. He added, I really think that the international tourists are already well aware of the issue facing the Great Barrier Reef. Some tourism operators point out that there are still many great places to go on the Great Barrier Reef, and visitors are still as awed by their experience as ever. But Dr. John Day says those great areas that operators rightly identify won't continue to be great in the future. He added, it's really short-sighted perspective. Those great areas are going to be suffering very soon. He says if the Queensland jewel does find itself on the danger list, there could be positives. It's not just a slap on the wrist, but actually a chance to bring this to the world's attention. Dr. John Day says Australia has always fought criticisms of the World Heritage properties, especially when the threat of an in danger listing is raised. He says Australia lobbied intensively to keep the Northern Territory's Kakadu National Park off the list in 1999, after concerns over uranium mining and its effects on Aboriginal sites. He says that's left a very sour taste in many countries' mouths. People still talk about it. He added, this should not be about arguing and fighting. It is about the world recognizing that its heritage is under threat and then doing something about it. Professor Tiffany Morrison of James Cook University led research published last year into all the times when the World Heritage Committee has considered putting natural sites, known in United Nations language as properties, on the danger list. Professor Tiffany Morrison found countries such as Australia, with economies dependent on high-value natural resources, regardless of their state of development, tended to push back on UNESCO's recommendations. Professor Tiffany Morrison said, if the committee did ignore Australia's pleading this time, an appearance on the in danger list would mean Australia would need to start taking climate policy seriously. She added, "We would hope that climate policy would get Australia back off the in danger list," adding, "I think UNESCO are trying to force Australia's hand. That is why we have these international conventions. They're supposed to have teeth." She said there were two competing forces at play as Australia tries to make its lobbying count. Professor Morrison said, "This is actually about reputational risk, both from Australia and UNESCO's point of view," adding, "The more Australia gets away with its lobbying, the more reputational damage there is to UNESCO." Dr. Simon Cripps, the Executive Director of Marine Conservation at the International Wildlife Conservation Society, says one site makes its way onto the World Heritage List, as the Great Barrier Reef did back in 1981, it's not the end of a journey. Actually, it's the beginning. He says, "As with your house or your car, sites need constant maintenance to keep them in a healthy condition. Australia is a land of environmental paradoxes, in that their fantastic work to conserve and sustainably manage the marine environment right around their coastline has set an example to so many other countries." He noted, "Yet it is undermined by their appalling performance on combating climate change that will cause huge environmental damage, social and economic damage to the very coast that they are seeking to protect." Back in Belize, the marine scientist and World Wildlife Fund campaigner Nadia Boog says, "It took plenty of political will to get her country's reef off the danger list. As a 15-year-old rural farm girl, Nadia Boog had never seen her country's famous barrier reef until she dived in for a school field trip." Boog, from her home in Belize City, says, "It was just like, wow, it was then I decided to be a marine scientist." She said, "As humans, we're dependent on all the species. They allow us to live the life we're living. They give us our food and shelter, and the reef protects us from storms." She added, "We have to try and protect them as much as possible. Australia and our reefs are sisters. We can be championing each other."
Inside Israel. The Israeli regime has backtracked on plans to enforcement of a decision requiring Israeli army personnel and guards to leave their guns at work. The regime, several months ago, decided to ban security guards from taking their guns at home at the end of their shifts. The order came after the killing of a woman by her partner, who worked as an armed security guard at a school. But now, the regime has cited the possible outbreak of security disturbances over a planned annexation of parts of the occupied West Bank as the reason for delaying the enforcement of the decision. So why did authorities backtrack on their gun control plans? An earlier report by Haaretz newspaper estimated the number of weapons possessed by private security guards at around 31,000, while firearms in the hands of ordinary citizens were estimated at 148,000. And that does not even consider the large number of weapons carried outside of military and police bases and storehouses by members of Israeli security forces. Over the years, the Israeli regime has been making it easier for average Israelis to obtain gun licenses. But instead of increasing security, it has only put more people, especially women, at risk. What are the risks of Israel's lax gun rules?
Right now in Israel, there's a lot of small businesses that are running out of money, shutting down. A lot of frustration, a lot of anger, a lot of protest. In this kind of situation, where a second lockdown may well be underway, and where the economic situation is quite uncertain, to allow guards to take their guns home is absolute madness. The Israeli regime is adding fuel to the fire.
Israel's Public Security Ministry has been promoting its plan to hand out guns since 2015. In October 2015, citing Palestinian retaliatory attacks on Israeli soldiers, the Israeli Public Security Ministry issued an order easing up on getting a gun license. In March 2016, the Knesset decided that due to the security situation, security guards will be allowed to carry weapons outside their places of work. In October 2017, in response to a potential reconciliation agreement between Fatah in the occupied West Bank and Hamas in the besieged Gaza Strip, the ministry announced that it would encourage all Israeli citizens to carry firearms in order to provide better personal security. In July 2018, the ministry announced that it was encouraging thousands of citizens to carry guns and that every citizen who has undergone military combat training would be eligible to obtain a license. This technically allowed over 800,000 to carry arms. Does Israel's gun policy revolve around Palestinians?
The Israeli settlers operating in the occupied West Bank are pretty much armed militias. They can shoot innocent Palestinians and get away with it. In fact, there's been various murders of Palestinians, and there's been many unaccounted murders. What the Israeli colonialists can do is just to claim that stones were thrown at them and that their lives were in danger, and their versions are taken at face value by the Israeli court system very frequently. So you have a situation where some of the population is armed, but the Palestinians are not armed, and it's an unfair ballgame.
That was then. The scheme that was supposed to have made Israelis feel secure didn't work because these same people who were bringing their firearms home or were obtaining firearms through the encouragement of the Israeli Public Security Ministry were killing Israelis. So instead, violence has increased and the main victims were Israeli civilians, including women and immigrants. Small arms policy in Israel is a policy of life and death. It determines who is authorized to purchase, hold, and operate a tool that unleashes lethal force at the pull of a trigger. It determines where, when, and under what circumstances the trigger finger is to be used and what type of oversight gun owners and shooters are subject to. The rising number of gun ownership in Israel has made the conversation on social media. According to Gary Smith, not just Jews, every good citizen should take charge of their own safety. Police can't be everywhere. According to Raymond Coley, also in Israel, you need police certificate to buy a handgun. Mental background check is also done. But in the U.S., people might claim it's invasion of privacy. Sorry, we do need to give up something here to protect our kids and everyone else. Dr. Foxen says that she's so sick of this argument. If guns were illegal, less people would have them. Period. End of discussion. Alan Fisher says, while citing Israel's Channel 10, 300,000 guns in private hands in Israel, including security guards, tied to number of recent murders. What about Israelis? What do they think about all this? Do Israelis agree that guns should be so easily available? Should military personnel and guards leave their guns at work? Here in Israel, small arms policy molds culture, behavior, habits, and social environment. It constructs a particular consciousness and educates youth. It is also reciprocally formed by all of those same elements. At least 60% of all applications for gun permits are accepted. The illegal settlers living in occupied Palestinian territories are actually encouraged by authorities to keep weapons on hand. Israelis living in occupied territories, known as settlers, who receive all the benefits of Israeli citizens within pre-1948 Palestine, are militarily trained to shoot Palestinians under the pretext that they were possibly going to commit an attack. Firearms are already prevalent among settlers. Former high-ranking army officials are permitted to carry weaponry, and summer camps in Israel have also been known to teach children as young as 10 how to use rifles.
Well, I think everybody's a victim in this situation. I mean, who's dying? Well, we know that women are dying disproportionately. We know that people are dying by suicide, and I suspect a lot of those are IDF veterans. There's a surprisingly high incidence of PTSD in IDF veterans, and you might ask, well, why? I mean, they're rarely put in danger. But there's another way to get PTSD. When you are killing innocent civilians or watching them be killed, and you don't want to be a part of that, that creates a moral injury, and that is just as severe as the kind of symptoms of PTSD you can get from killing people yourself. It's not uncommon. There's a fair amount of concern about PTSD in Israel, but I sincerely doubt that they're attributing it to moral injury, because that would be admitting that what they're doing is wrong.
Israel has often been accused of perpetuating a gun culture by allowing Jewish residents to act with impunity in using firearms, a trend that Palestinians have called incitement. A poll by the Israel Democracy Institute found that over half of Israeli citizens support the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians accused of attacks on the spot, even after their arrest. A report by Human Rights Watch earlier this year also found that senior military officers have been promoting such a practice on the ground, irrespective of whether the Palestinians pose a threat to life. Why are indigenous Arab populations the victims of gun violence? Israeli Arabs, or the indigenous population of Israel, has long been possibly one of the biggest victims of firearms. Since the beginning of 2020, at least 46 Arab Israelis have been murdered, and 12 of them in May alone. But so far, only 5 murders have been solved by the police. The community has blamed Israeli authorities for neglecting their cities and towns. The community's dissatisfaction is a result of insufficient everyday policing combined with the over-policing of political demonstrations. Alienation between the police and the Arab public exacerbated in 2000 when the police brutally killed 13 Arab protesters with impunity, according to the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace think tank. It worsened again in 2017 as a result of two issues. The continued police killings of Arab citizens and the demolition of buildings in the city of Qalanswa in central Israel. Moreover, back in July 2018, Israel passed the Jewish Nation State Law, which declares Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people, downgrades Arabic from an official language to a language with special status, and encourages the development of Jewish settlements. These recent developments only heighten the sense of hostility and alienation Arabs feel emanating from Israel and its institutions. What are the politics behind Israel's gun violence?
From 2002 until 2013, when Israel had a very liberal gun control mechanism where they would allow guards to take their guns home, there were about 3 murders every year carried out by these same guns that were allowed by the regime. And then once that was stopped and they had to leave the guns at work, these murders stopped as well. When the parliament was discussing this issue, there was an Israeli guard who told there was an Israeli citizen who told the parliamentarians that both of his parents and his grandmother were shot in his home. His plea was ignored by the parliamentarians, and now they're going ahead again and allowing guards to take their guns home.
The illicit gun trade in Israel thrives, and the police can barely catch up. Israel police confiscated 3,250 illegally held firearms as of June 2020. Additionally, according to a police press release, police arrested 1,713 suspects for alleged firearms-related crimes, and 653 people were indicted following investigations. The release pointed out that it would be nearly impossible to unearth these hidden guns without inside sources working for them in communities. Police claim that hardly a day goes by without them confiscating such weapons. Israeli police confiscated 600 pistols and 100 hand grenades, as well as several landmines and plastic explosives since January 2020. The weapons are usually kept by criminals who use them to commit acts of violence that target people and other gang members. As of 2017, the number of both illicit and legal firearms in Israel is over 557,000, according to gunpolicy.org. Is Israel gradually becoming like the U.S. with regards to gun ownership?
Again, I don't have statistics. Certainly, gun ownership is increasing. It's increasing in the United States, too. But I don't think that's so much from new people buying guns. There's some of that. But by people stocking up on guns and ammunition who already had guns. In the United States, it's considered a constitutional right, and that's a big issue. They're afraid. A lot of people who own guns are afraid that the government will take away their guns. This is not the same thing in Israel. The government is trying to get them to take guns. They're encouraging that. So I don't think it's the same thing. I think it's a different culture because also in Israel, of course, it's almost everyone there who was in Israel, at least up into their early 20s, is a veteran, except for some of the Orthodox Jews. Those people, I don't know how many of them leave the military thinking they need a gun to be safe, and how many of them maybe are sickened by what they've done and don't want to have anything to do with guns. They used to make them give them back, as I said earlier, when they left the military, and they still do with enlisted men and women. And I think there's probably a good reason for that. You know, if they're trained to kill and they're trained to regard the people they're confronting as the enemy, it's dangerous to send those people out into society, just like it is in the United States, where we have a militarized police now that's causing riots, the reaction against the militarized police who regard the public as the enemy. I'm sure there's some of that spillover, especially with Israeli Arabs.
A significant expansion of the pool of people eligible for gun licenses are based, of course, on their national origin and military training. Israel also eased processes for renewing existing licenses, making renewal all but automatic. Repeated public announcements actively encourage people to arm themselves, to carry guns at all times, and most of all, to use them Hollywood style. That is, a fast draw and a lethal aim, supposedly riding to the rescue of innocents faced by bad guys. After years of coming under scrutiny by Israelis who have been victims of gunfire, the ministry finally decided that it was time to prohibit guards, police, and military members from taking their firearms home after work. The decision was made earlier this year. Now, this is not the case anymore, as these entities are allowed to take their guns home with them. Israel wants to have a similar gun policy to the U.S. It wants all citizens to carry weapons, as it feels it cannot protect everyone.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The partial genome sequences address an evolutionary conundrum about the early genetic diversity of the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, although scientists emphasize that they do not shed light on its origins. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ewan Calloway, researcher. This article is published under the heading, Deleted Coronavirus Genome Sequences Trigger Scientific Intrigue. Stay tuned for more. Efforts to study the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic has received help from a surprising source. A biologist in the United States has excavated partial SARS-CoV-2 genome sequences from the beginning of the pandemic's probable epicenter that were deposited but later removed from a U.S. government database. The partial genome sequences address an evolutionary conundrum about the early genetic diversity of the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, although scientists emphasize that they do not shed light on its origins. Nor is it fully clear why researchers at Wuhan University asked for the sequences to be removed from the sequence Red Archive, SRA, a repository for raw sequencing data maintained by the National Center for Biotechnology Information, NCBI, part of the U.S. National Institute of Health, NIH. These sequences are informative, they're not transformative, says Jess Bloom, a viral evolutionary geneticist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington, who describes in a 22 June preprint how he recovered the sequences. Bloom discovered the sequences after searching for genomic data from the pandemic's early stages. A research paper from May 2020 contained a table of publicly available sequence data, which included entries Bloom had not come across. The sequences were associated with a paper in which researchers used nanopore sequencing technology to detect SARS-CoV-2 genetic material in samples from people. That study was published in the journal Small in June 2020, having been posted on BioRxiv in March of that year. When Bloom looked for the sequences in SRA using the details listed in the May 2020 paper, the database returned no entries. The SRA keeps sequences in cloud storage maintained by Google, and Bloom wondered whether he could find archived versions of the sequences on cloud servers. This approach worked, and Bloom was able to recover data from 50 samples, 13 of which contained enough raw data to generate partial genome sequences. The sequences helped to solve an evolutionary mystery about the early stages of the pandemic, says Bloom. The earliest viral sequences are from individuals linked to the city's Hunan seafood market in December 2019, which was initially thought to be where the coronavirus first jumped from animals to people. But the seafood market sequences are more distantly related to SARS-CoV-2's closest relatives in bats, the most likely ultimate origin of the virus, than are later sequences, including one collected in the United States. That was surprising, says Bloom, because you would expect that viruses from the early stages of Wuhan's epidemic would be most closely related to SARS-CoV-2's relatives that infect bats. The recovered sequences, which were probably collected in January and February 2020, show this to be the case. They're more closely related to the bat viruses than are the sequences from people linked to the seafood market. This adds to a growing body of evidence, including reports of probable cases dating back to November 2019, that the first human cases of COVID-19 were not associated with the Hunan seafood market, say Bloom and other scientists. To me, it seemed like Wuhan market was one of the first super spreading events, says Sudhir Kumar, an evolutionary geneticist at the Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The sequences that Bloom unearthed, he adds, suggest that SARS-CoV-2 developed extensive diversity in the early stages of the pandemic. Stephen Goldstein, a virologist at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, points out that the sequences Bloom recovered were not hidden. They are described in detail with enough sequence information to know their evolutionary relationship to other early SARS-CoV-2 sequences in the small paper. Goldstein says, "I don't think this preprint tells us a whole lot that's new, but it does bring to the forefront sequence data that has been publicly available, though under the radar." Bloom says that although the sequences were published, the removal from SRA meant that few scientists knew about them. A report commissioned by the World Health Organization on the pandemic's origins did not include the sequences in an evolutionary analysis of early SARS-CoV-2 data. Nobody noticed they existed, Bloom says. The corresponding authors of the small paper did not respond to questions from Nature's news team about why they asked for the sequences to be removed from the SRA, which happened before the paper was published. In a statement, the NIH said it removed the data at the request of the researchers, who said they planned to submit them to another database. Co-authored a letter calling for a renewed investigation into the origins of the pandemic, including the possibility that the virus escaped or leaked from a lab, says his study sheds no light on the origins of the pandemic, nor on why the sequences were removed. But he hopes his efforts will encourage researchers to think outside the box and look to other sources, such as archival data, to glean more information from the early days of the pandemic. There are probably more data out there, he says.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
I tell you with confidence, the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and it will not stop. May 7th, 2021. Israel is not a country. Another noteworthy point is that although that the usurping regime was established in 1948, the ground for occupying that sensitive Islamic region had been prepared years before that. Studying those events in Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries stretching from West Asia to North Africa reveals this bitter truth that weakness and discord in the Islamic Ummah paved the way for the disastrous usurpation of Palestine, allowing the world of arrogance to deliver that blow to the Islamic Ummah. It is instructive that at that time, the capitalism and communism camps colluded with the rich Zionists. It was the English who masterminded the plot and who persisted in it, and then Zionist capitalists executed it with their money and weapons. The Soviet Union, too, was one of the first governments that officially recognized the establishment of that illegitimate regime and later on dispatched a large number of Jews to that area. The usurping regime was actually an outcome of that situation in the world of Islam on the one hand, and of a European plot, invasion and transgression on the other. Today, the situation in the world is not like those days. We should keep this reality within sight. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the world of Islam. Various political and social incidents in Europe and in the United States have laid bare the weaknesses and the deep structural, managerial, and moral conflicts among Westerners. The electoral events in the US and the notoriously scandalous failures of the hubristic and arrogant managers in that country, the unsuccessful one-year fight against the pandemic in the US and Europe, and the embarrassing incidents that ensued, and also the recent political and social instabilities in the most important European countries, are all signs of the downward movement of the Western camp. On the other hand, the growth of the resistance forces in the most sensitive Islamic regions, the development of their defensive and offensive capabilities, their growth of self-awareness, motivation and hope in Muslim nations, the increasing tendency to follow Islamic and Quranic slogans, growth in science and growth of independence and self-reliance nations are auspicious signs of a better future.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Chafornak, a Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. The article you're about to hear has been written by a New York Times journalist, Christopher Falavelle, and Kaylin Goodluck. The piece is titled, Dispossessed Again, Climate Change Hits Native Americans Especially Hard. Chafornak, a Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. I love our building, said Eliza Tunichuk, one of the teachers. At the same time, I want to move from here. The village, where the median income is about $11,000 a year, sought help from the federal government to build a new school on dry land, one of dozens of buildings in Chafornak that must be relocated. But agency after agency offered variations on the same response. No. From Alaska to Florida, Native Americans are facing severe climate challenges, the newest threat in the history of Native Americans marked by centuries of distress and dislocation. While other communities struggle on a warming planet, Native American tribes are experiencing an environmental peril exacerbated by policies, first imposed by white settlers and later by the United States government, that forced them onto the country's least desirable lands. And now, climate change is quickly making that marginal land uninhabitable. The first Americans faced the loss of home once again. In the Pacific Northwest, coastal erosion and storms are eating away at tribal land, forcing Native American communities to try to move inland. In the Southwest, severe drought means the Navajo Nation is running out of drinking water. At the edge of the Ozarks, heirloom crops are becoming harder to grow, threatening to disconnect the Cherokee from their heritage. Compounding the damage from its past decisions, the U.S. federal government has continued to neglect Native American communities, where substandard housing and infrastructure make it harder to cope with climate shocks. The federal government is also less likely to help Native communities recover from extreme weather or help protect them against future calamities, according to a New York Times review of government data. Interviewed with officials, members, and advisors at 15 federally recognized tribes portray a gathering climate crisis and a test of the country's renewed focus on racial equity and environmental justice. Many tribes have been working to meet the challenges posed by the changing climate, and they have expressed hope that their concerns would be addressed by President Joe Biden, who has committed to repairing the relationship with tribal nations and appointed Deb Haaland, the first indigenous cabinet secretary, to run the Interior Department. But Joe Biden has announced few specific policies or actions to directly reduce the climate risk already facing Native American communities. And Ms. Deb Haaland's office declined repeated requests for an interview. The stakes are very, very high, said Fawn Sharp, president of the National Congress of American Indians. She added, "We're running out of time." Chilute Nation is a collection of about 135 homes on a narrow slice of land at the edge of the Olympic Peninsula that juts into the Pacific Ocean about 100 miles west of Seattle. As temperatures rise, the atmosphere holds more water, producing more frequent and intense storms. High winds now regularly knock out the electricity, while homes along the main street are vulnerable to flooding. The single road that connects the community to the outside world is often rendered impassable by water. The village is 10 to 15 feet above sea level, said Susan Devine, a project manager who is working with the Chilute. During major storms, those waves are bigger than you, she said. Hundreds of years ago, the reservation was a fishing village, among many locations used by the Chilute as they moved according to the demands of the weather. That changed in 1855, when a treaty stripped the tribe of most of its land. U.S. President at the time, Grover Cleveland, later issued an executive order confining the Chilute to a single square mile, and all of it exposed to flooding. No one chose to be in a seasonal fishing area year-round, Ms. Devine said. The resulting vulnerability has pushed the tribe to pursue a solution that few non-native towns in the United States have seriously considered, retreating to higher ground. Climate change has forced us to make the heart-wrenching decision to leave this village, Doug Woodruff, chairman of the Chilute Tribal Council, said in a December statement. Without a cohesive national and international strategy to address climate change, there is little we can do to combat these impacts. Through a spokeswoman, Doug Woodruff and other members of the council declined repeated requests to be interviewed. In 2012, Congress gave the tribe permission to relocate inside the adjacent Olympic National Park. But without a tax base to pay for its move, the tribe sought federal money. Progress has been slow. The Chilute received about $50 million in grants to build a new school farther from the coast, but the total cost to relocate homes and the other facilities could be 2 to 3 times that much, according to Larry Burtness, who manages federal grant applications for the Chilute. 40 miles south, the Quinault tribe has been working on its own plan to retreat from Tahola, the reservation's main town, for almost a decade. Tucked between a driftwood-strewn beach and a coastal rainforest, Tahola is exposed to storms, flooding, and frequent power outages. That tribe has also struggled to get federal help. There's no single source of revenue at the state level or congressionally to undertake these kinds of projects, said Ms. Sharp, who was president of Quinault Nation until March. The U.S. federal government offers help to communities coping with the effects of climate change, but Native Americans have often been less able to access that help than other Americans. "We're the most disproportionately impacted by climate, but we're the very least funded," said Anne-Marie Chischilly, executive director of the Institute for Tribal Environmental Professionals at Northern Arizona University. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is less likely to grant requests for aid from Native tribes recovering from disaster compared to non-Native communities, according to FEMA data. Native Americans are also less likely to have flood insurance, making it harder to rebuild. Of 574 federally recognized tribes, fewer than 50 participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, according to a review of FEMA data. That's partly because the federal government has completed flood maps for just one-third of federally recognized tribes, compared with the vast majority of counties. Flood maps can help the tribal leaders more precisely understand their flood risks and promote residents to purchase flood insurance. But insurance premiums can be prohibitively expensive for Native Americans. Individual households on Native American lands are also less likely to get federal help girding for disasters. Of the 59,303 properties that have received FEMA grants since 1998 to prepare for disasters, just 48 were on tribal lands, according to Carlos Martin, a researcher at the Urban Institute. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it is committed to improving tribal access to its programs. Chair Fonak's efforts to relocate its preschool illustrate the current difficulties of dealing with the federal government. While the Federal Emergency Management Agency offers grants to cope with climate hazards, replacing the school wasn't an eligible expense, according to Max Neal, a senior program manager at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium who helped Chair Fonak search for federal aid. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has a program to pay for infrastructure on tribal lands, but the maximum amount available wasn't enough for a new school, and the agency wouldn't grant money until the village had found other ways to make up the difference. Replacing the preschool would only begin to address Cherfanak's troubles. Some 24 homes need to be relocated, potentially costing more than $10 million, according to Sean Beginski, an engineer working with the village. And Cherfanak is just one of more than 100 native villages in Alaska alone that are exposed to significant climate risks.
World with reporters.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. It's quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Amina Taylor, London.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran,